contributions comes significant political sway. Mega donor Saban has had a strong foothold in politics for decades. In 2002, he gave $13 million to the Brookings Institution to establish the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, now the Center for Middle East Policy. The center's founding director, Martin Indyk, openly supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saban's money has also kept former President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in line with regard to the Zionist regime. The donations by Israel partisans have managed to keep almost every elected representative in Israel's pocket with almost no exceptions. Alison Weir, American journalist and founder of Research Institute, If Americans Knew, told Mint Press News. AIPAC's PACs aren't backed just by CEO investors, but also by the organization itself. AIPAC's own employees have channeled more than $80,000 into its regular PAC. Within that sum, AIPAC President Betsy Korn poured $10,000 into the regular PAC through her company, BVision Sports Media. AIPAC received widespread criticism for endorsing 109 of the 147 Republicans who voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election results following the January 6 insurrection at Capitol Hill. For Hickson, this development is telling because it underscores the growing divide among American Jews. AIPAC is becoming increasingly viewed as the Republican wing of the lobby, he said. Since its creation, a core tenet of AIPAC has been its bipartisanship, but Hickson believes AIPAC is moving farther and farther away from its original doctrine, explaining AIPAC hasn't cut off funding to Democrats who will take a pro-Israel line, but the fact that they support the far right and have identified so closely with former President Donald Trump is a significant change because it encourages these splits in a liberal Jewish so-called community. Polling suggests American Jews are becoming more critical of the fabricated regime of Israel, with a quarter considering it an apartheid regime. Democratic voters are also taking a harsher position on this regime, with a majority supporting sanctions over Israel's settlement activity and more than 40% believing the U.S. should withhold aid to the Zionist regime. A University of Maryland poll also found that fewer than 1% of Democratic respondents view the Zionist regime as the U.S. first or second most important ally. According to Smith, AIPAC has always purported to be unified voice of the American Jewish community, but that self-proclaimed title isn't true. During the joint IRMEP and American Educational Institute, Israel's Influence, Good or Bad for America, 2016 conference, Smith debunked the lobby's false narrative that Americans who are Jewish are all Israel Affinity Organization members who support lobbying from these groups. According to a 2013 Pew Research Center survey on Jewish identity, 82% of American Jews aren't members of Israel lobbying organizations. Smith accordingly asked at the conference, "So who does the lobby really represent? Well, the views and concerns of mega donors for sure. The views and concerns of a relatively small group of boards and directors and top officials, and of course, the Israeli regime, with which many are in direct and ongoing consultation." With Jewish and Democratic voters becoming less concerned with the alliance between the United States of America and the Zionist regime, the gap between representative and constituents appears to be widening. As Weir put it, it's a contest between the elites that fund candidates and the grassroots that often want something different. So we are seeing that the elites, almost all of whom are pro-Israel, will continue giving huge amounts of money to candidates and buying a lot of candidates that way.
the Shia Muslims in Nigeria. Mahadi can now walk and perform many chores, like fetching water for ablution to perform his 5 daily prayers. These were near impossible after the horror of the December 2015 Zaria massacre, where hundreds were murdered in cold blood. Hundreds like Mahdi received life-threatening injuries in the 3-day carnage. Walking for Mahdi was a torturous experience. Almost 3 years after the unbelievable horror, Mahdi still sits to vividly recall the atrocity. He was one of those shot and burnt alive by soldiers of the Nigerian army at Sheikh Zazaki's house in Gelesu, in the northern Nigerian city of Zaria, on December 13, 2015. Mahdi said he stayed without food for 72 hours and only survived because of the generosity of a good Samaritan who hid him away from the predators. During the carnage, Aisha was trapped in an upstairs building as intense shooting by the soldiers in Gelesu raged. Aisha said she survived by the grace of God. She had spent over 2 years treating bullet wounds on her leg. I apologize for making her recall the bitter experience.
An armed soldier will now go direct and face a private part of a lady and shoot, where grenades will be thrown to women to go and scatter their bodies. It happened. So it's a brutality that a heart will never imagine. And I will never like to see it again. The eye that saw it will never like to repeat it. It's very, very sudden.
It is totally condemnable. It is alien to our law. And it cannot be accepted in any civilized society. More so that up till now, none of the murderers has been brought to book, contrary to the recommendation of the Garba Judicial Commission of Inquiry and the white paper issued by the Kaduna State Government.
That on Saturday.
So Malama Amina Mustafa lost 3 children in the Zaria massacre. But above all, she lost her husband, who she said was a friend, a reliable confidant, and a responsible and loving spouse. Malama said she misses her husband every day. Back in 2017, during the International Quds Day rally in Kaduna, her surviving son, Hussein, was shot in the back by the Nigerian police. She said Hussein lost a lot of blood at the scene and eventually became paralyzed from the waist down. Hussein has since dropped out of school because none of the available institutions have infrastructural provisions for the fiscally challenged. She says caring for Hussein is a difficult task. Every day, Malama says she wonders at the viciousness of the Zaria massacre, especially the seeming absence of humanity in the perpetrators. Victims of the Zaria massacre live in many households in many cities in northern Nigeria. We visited many homes in Zaria and Kaduna. We moved from one house to the other knocking on doors in the hope of listening to their accounts of what many described as the reprehensible crimes committed against their spouses, relatives, and friends. This is the family of Ibrahim Ahmed Badiko, who was killed in the Zaria massacre. He left 12 children and 3 wives. One of the wives was pregnant when he died. Now the children are 13 without a breadwinner. The Shuhada Foundation was conceived and established by the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Zazaki, in January 1992. It is now headed by Sheikh Abdulhamid Bello, who says the main objective for setting up the foundation is to cater to the needs of the families of the martyrs who lost their lives during the struggle to establish the cause of justice.
And from time to time, the clampdown, you know, is increasing from time to time. So, but the worst one is what happened in this 2015. Which we are registering almost 1,000 shuhada as a result of the clampdown by this Buhari administration.
Most organizations depend on assistance from donors. However, Sheikh Abdulhamid says the Shuhada Foundation has different ways of raising funds for taking care of the orphans and families of the martyrs.
We have what we call the Shuhada dues. We have it every, it has started by 5 naira. Every member of the Shuhada, the movement will give a monthly 5 naira as a due. So, but now it has come to 100 naira per month.
The Islamic movement holds the annual Shuhada Day in order to remember the contribution of the martyrs, to assess performance, and to find ways of restructuring the organization for better performance. Most of these orphans are children of the hundreds of members of the Islamic movement killed in the December 2015 Zaria massacre. The Shuhada Foundation says the task of catering for their needs has become even more challenging.
Before 2015, we have less than 300 children of the Shuhada that we take care of. But now we have over 2,000. You see, not even doubling, not even tripling. So, and from these children that they have increased in number, also, their own demand is more than before. Because most of those, 300 at that time, we have, in terms of education, for instance, most of them are in primary or secondary school. We have less than 10 that we are in the higher institutions. But now, we have more than 100 who are in the higher institutions.
Assalamu alaikum. We arrived at the house of late Abdullahi Abbas in Zaria to meet the family he left behind. Abdullahi Abbas was killed along with his 3 sons in Gelesu, the residence of Sheikh Zazaki. His senior wife expressed a lot of gratitude for the work of the Shuhada Foundation. She expressed her grief at the loss of her husband and sons, but said the final judgment will be done by Almighty God. The accounts by victims of the mass murders in Zaria are varied. They also vary in their horror and intensity. But all the accounts are united by one common feature. They were heinous crimes committed against members of a minority religious group that were unarmed. Experts have continued to insist that the 2015 bloodbath in Zaria amounts to genocide.
Once you, in a reckless manner, unleash such advanced mayhem on a member of an ethnic group or a religious body without any provocation, without any basis whatsoever, and more so, if they are unarmed, it's akin to genocide, which is a crime against humanity. And it's worse where the government refuses to bring the murderers to book.
Malama Zainab Sanusi still walks with a limp. She is also in perpetual pain because of bullets buried in various parts of her body. Malama Zainab narrated her harrowing experience in the hands of the soldiers who attacked the residence of Sheikh Zazaki in December 2015. Perhaps what was more despicable and cold-hearted, according to Malama Zainab, was when one of the soldiers threw a bullet at her as a souvenir. Counsel for Sheikh Zazaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria, who is also a human rights activist, says beyond trying to get justice for the criminality of the massacre, the surviving victims still have another avenue towards getting justice.
I've suggested to the Shia community to put together all the numbers of all the victims, identify them one by one, because the laws, our laws allow them, and I'm talking of the relations of the victims of the dead, to ask for compensation. But what I'm talking about will be the civil action against the government, the federal government, whose army killed unarmed innocent civilians.
For about 3 years, Sheikh Zazaki has remained in custody despite the ruling of a federal high court in Abuja, the Nigerian capital. The court ruled that Sheikh Zazaki's fundamental human rights have been violated. It asked the Nigerian government to set him free within 45 days, to pay him compensation, and to build a house for him following the destruction of his house by the Kaduna State government and soldiers of the Nigerian army. The Nigerian government has not obeyed the ruling of the court. It has also turned a deaf ear to all protests and pleas for the release of the Islamic cleric to go for medical treatment. Sheikh Zazaki lost an eye during the attack and is losing the other one. In a twist, the Kaduna State government has arraigned Sheikh Zazaki on a Kaduna High Court. Sheikh Zazaki is charged with unlawful assembly, criminal conspiracy, and culpable homicide punishable by death. Members of the Islamic movement have rejected these charges. Many of the victims of the Zaria massacre have lost their jobs. Some, like Aisha Yakub, have been forced to drop out of school, while others have been divorced from their spouses because of almost 3 years of separation due to detention prison. These serious issues have raised questions about human rights in Nigeria.
It's not rocket science to respect the rights of people. These are not illiterates or dropouts. These are well-educated people. And you need to respect their feelings, their views, and engage them in serious discussion. You can't crush them.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria strongly believes that an international conspiracy was responsible for the 2015 Zaria attack and the subsequent persecution of the Shia community that has continued up to now.
If you remember, the Saudi crown prince was in Saudi Arabia some months back. And he granted interview to the Time magazine. There, he listed his achievement, 3 years achievement. And there he said, crushing the Shia's influence in Nigeria. He mentioned Nigeria specifically. So it's not a mistake for anybody to say it was planned by Israel and America and sponsored by Saudi Arabia, implemented by a mass murderer.
Whatever the reasons behind the 2015 Zaria attack, some experts believe that the global enemies of Islam must be smiling with satisfaction at the outcome of the events regarding the Islamic movement in Nigeria. These attacks and crackdown, experts explained, are not good for the global unity of Islam.
Unfortunately, some leaders in the Muslim world are dancing to the tunes of their enemies, you know, by deepening the crisis and stoking, you know, this conflict that continues to fractionalize as well as divide, you know, Muslims of different faith.
There are many pending issues regarding the December 2015 massacre in Zaria. For example, who is going to answer for the 347 men, women and children killed and buried in a mass grave on the outskirts of Kaduna?
As for those who did this shameful act, it's for them to be brought to book and be punished according to the law. Alhamdulillah, we have a case in the International Court of Justice, that is the ICC. We want the incoming government to give... to hand them over to ICC whenever the need arises. And certainly, the Islamic movement will not hesitate to take them to court again within the country.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria also alleges that there are still dozens of girls abducted by the Nigerian military and hundreds of others who are still unaccounted for. Darul Rahama, during the 2015 massacre, was among the several properties of the Islamic movement that was desecrated and destroyed by the Kaduna State government. Members still visit the cemetery to offer prayers to their fallen members.
Our situation is worse than the one found in Israel. There is no human being or no group, I mean, that was oppressed or is being oppressed, as I'm talking to you, like the Shiite community.
We made several trips to the offices of the Attorney General and the Nigerian Minister of Justice and wrote several letters in order to get the response of the Nigerian government regarding the issue of the Shia Muslims, especially the case of Sheikh Zazaki. But the minister did not respond to our request for an interview. The Nigerian military and the Kaduna State government were also unwilling to grant interviews on the matter. Meanwhile, protests, both at home and abroad, have continued as the Nigerian Shia community demands for justice from a democratic government that has sworn to be fair to all Nigerians.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Brussels has vowed to respond with all measures at its disposal as Britain's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss sets out plan to make changes and rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. We now present you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart, Jennifer Rankin and Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled EU Raises Spectre of Trade War if UK Rewrites Northern Ireland Protocol. The European Commission has raised the spectre of an economically damaging trade war with the United Kingdom, pledging to respond with all measures at its disposal if Foreign Secretary Liz Truss presses ahead with a plan to rewrite the Northern Ireland Protocol. The Foreign Secretary set out plans on Tuesday, 17th of May, to table a bill that would make changes to the protocol, including waiving all checks on goods flowing from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, where they are not destined for the Republic of Ireland. She said the UK government still hoped to agree the changes it believes are necessary, calling these comprehensive and reasonable, adding, "Our preference is to reach a negotiated outcome with the European Union. We have worked tirelessly to that end and will continue to do so." But she claimed the protocol in its current form jeopardised the stability of the Good Friday Agreement, which she said was under strain, and the government would act unilaterally if necessary. Liz Truss said, "To respond to the very grave and serious situation in Northern Ireland, we are clear that there is a necessity to act to ensure the institutions can be restored as soon as possible." Part of the government's motivation is to placate the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which is refusing to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin at Stormont, unless the protocol is altered. The Democratic Unionist Party's Westminster leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, said Liz Truss's statement was welcome, if overdue step, that is, a significant move towards addressing the problems created by the Northern Ireland Protocol and getting power sharing based upon a cross-community consensus up and running again. Geoffrey Donaldson said his party would like to see progress on the legislation in days and weeks, and not months. Liz Truss called for the EU's top official in charge of relations with the United Kingdom, Maroš Šefčovič, to be given a rewritten negotiating mandate that would allow the protocol to be revised. However, Maroš Šefčovič responded to Liz Truss's statement by issuing a veiled warning that the United Kingdom could lose its free trade arrangements with the European Union if it went ahead. Šefčovič, a European Commission Vice President who has been leading talks on changes to the protocol, said Liz Truss's proposals raise significant concerns, adding, "Unilateral actions contradicting an international agreement are not acceptable." He said in a statement, "Should the United Kingdom decide to move ahead with a bill disapplying constitutive elements of the protocol as announced today by the UK government, the European Union will need to respond with all measures at its disposal." According to Catherine Barnard, a European Union law professor at the University of Cambridge, the EU could hit UK goods with tariffs within 7 days of legal action or freeze the entire trade deal agreed with Prime Minister Boris Johnson in 2020. Two of three immediate weapons at its disposal. Legal action against the United Kingdom that was frozen as a goodwill gesture last year would probably be restarted. Liz Truss said the new legislation will be published within weeks, including plans to create a green channel allowing goods to be exported from Great Britain to Northern Ireland without checks, as long as they're not destined for the Republic of Ireland. She said this would create a dual regulatory system that encompasses either European Union or British regulation, as those businesses chose. That reflects its unique status of having a close relationship with the European Union while being part of the United Kingdom's single market. The legislation would also let the United Kingdom determine tax and spending in Northern Ireland. Liz Truss pointed to the Chancellor's recent decision to cut value-added tax VAT on green energy installations, which she said he was unable to implement in Northern Ireland. Brussels sources say no decisions have been taken about how to respond if Liz Truss does legislate, and express hope that Britain would turn to the negotiating table to discuss changes proposed by the EU. It was suggested that if the government tabled the bill, Brussels would issue a formal warning and launch a process to decide on retaliatory measures. European Union insiders believe that Britain has never seriously engaged with what they see as far-reaching proposals to lighten customs and administrative checks made by Mara Šefčovič last October. However, Liz Truss dismissed these in the House of Commons. She said, "Their current proposals are not able to address the fundamental concerns. In fact, it is our assessment that they would go backward from the situation we have today with the standstill." European Union sources also point out that a change in mandate would require unanimous sign-off by all member states of the European Union. They said there was no desire to change Šefčovič's mandate to enable wholesale changes to the protocol, a matter Liz Truss described as a fundamental issue. The senior EU diplomat poured cold water on this idea, saying, "The European Union doesn't have a mandate, the protocol is the mandate." The resurgence of the Northern Ireland row with Britain is seen by the European Union as an unwelcome distraction at a time of tension and conflict between Russia and Ukraine. David McAllister, a German Christian Democrat, MEP, who chairs the European Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, said, "If you look at what is happening in the middle of Europe, a fully-fledged military operation, a horrible, horrific war, and we're discussing again and again issues in Northern Ireland, which I believe could be solved with a bit of goodwill in London." Richard Neal, the influential chair of the US Congressional Committee, who is heading to London and Brussels in the coming days in an attempt to supposedly head off further deterioration of Anglo-Irish relations, said Northern Ireland shouldn't be held hostage in the political process. Rather, all parties must stay the course and continue to work together to find durable solutions. Richard Neal is leading a delegation of at least half a dozen US congressional representatives to Europe amid rising tension over the Northern Ireland protocol. Richard Neal's trip will take in London, Brussels, Dublin, and Belfast.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
Cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine, the United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those angles, if you could briefly mention?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is very refreshing to see. Indeed.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I know I was shot at in my car with a machine gun," and then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this." And so began the Intifada.
But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, mm-hmm. Of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. And you know, I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually, for a long time, the only way out of this conflict has been death. Mm-hmm. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. Mm-hmm. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the documentary, you also see lots of statistics. It was filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show, then, that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realised it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realise is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians is now in excess of 10,000. So that the act of the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths. And that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground. It is talking to people, you know, who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming, yes.
Yeah, indeed. Exactly. And so, you know, what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. Mm-hmm. And you know, to see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Hayadu Aglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting, without being able to control it, we are reenacting what happened to us, as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yeah, so that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, mm-hmm. which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident. It's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect through this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why, then, is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly make statements, pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society, which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and then when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the U.S. government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world, and the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain Israel lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel lobby in the United States, and the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world, and I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so, and if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it, and there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it is worth seeking out for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Amid an energy crisis caused by the conflict in Ukraine, climate experts say November talks in Egypt must act on plans to limit global heating. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, "This is about survival. Will COP27 bring action on Glasgow Climate Pact?" When weary delegates stumbled out of the emptying halls of the Scottish Event campus into the chill of a Glasgow night last November, the mood was buoyant if exhausted. Workers in high visibility began dismantling stages and pulling down scaffolding as the departing representatives of nearly 200 countries exchanged weak high fives and wry grins. After 2 weeks of grueling climate talks, there was an outcome. The world had agreed at last to make concrete plans to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. True, the deal reached in Glasgow was fragile. Most countries came to the COP26 climate summit without carbon-cutting plans of the level of stringency scientists said were needed. They left the talks with targets that would imply heating of about 1.9 degrees Celsius, a historic achievement compared to the 6 degrees Celsius of heating we were heading towards a decade ago, but still far off the 1.5 degrees Celsius, the figure scientists say is the threshold of safety. That left plenty to do in the months ahead. Alok Sharma, Britain's cabinet minister who presided over the COP26 summit, summed up the agreement soon after as one that was on life support. He wrote in the